Talking today with Dr. Jason Luss from Oklahoma State University's Ag Econ Department. And Jason, let's talk a little bit about two or three subjects I wanted to kind of chat with you today about. Might start with the food demand survey. This is something, you're in your third or fourth year now with this particular work. What kind of got you interested in trying this type of a nationwide survey?
That's right. So for more than 3 years, about 3.5 years now, we send a survey every single month to over 1,000 U.S. food consumers. It's a different sample every month. And I'd been interested in this for probably 10 years now, and finally, just with support from folks at the university and a USDA grant, was able to get the finances together to make it happen. But I thought there was a real need to put sort of a bit of a finger on the pulse of the American food consumer. There's a lot of data, of course, about food and ag prices, but it's hard to sometimes disentangle what's happening on the supply side of issues from the demand side. So I wanted to keep a real keen focus on consumer demand and then also just pay attention to what things consumers are worried about. Maybe give us a little bit of an anticipation about what issues may be emerging as important issues in the news, whether people are even paying attention to the stuff that we in agriculture think is important. Are people even paying attention to it? And then lastly, to give producers, agribusinesses, retailers some potential insight about maybe even where prices might be heading or where things might be going, so people can plan ahead and think a little bit about it. So that's the overall motivation. And so it's been a fun ride along the process, and hopefully we've learned a few things too.
The willingness to pay part of the survey, heavily weighted to meat products. What do you feel that you're really learning from consumers, you know, as you look at the data maybe over a, you know, multi-month or even a multi-year period now?
So I think probably the most important takeaway for me is that demand for meat products has remained very stable over the last 3 years. Yes, there are ups and downs from month to month, and sometimes it makes sense. So, for example, people say they're willing to pay a little more in February when it gets close to Super Bowl time. So that makes sense. Sometimes there's just random variation, and we don't really know why it happens. But if you take a step back and look at the broad view, really what we see is really steady, if not slightly increasing, consumer willingness to pay for most beef, pork, and chicken products. And that's important to me for a number of reasons. One is there's been a lot of negative publicity about meat in the news over the last 2 or 3 years. You know, supposedly red meat causes cancer. Red meat contributes to global warming. These are things you see in the headlines all the time. They are things that what I would call the sort of elite media pays a lot of attention to. And what I would say, at least from our survey, is that whatever impacts those issues have been having in the news, they really haven't had much impact on consumer demand per se. So I think that's been pretty interesting that demand has been very resilient. The other thing I would say too is that, you know, we've had big run up in pork and beef prices, and those started to come back down now. But because the willingness to pay or the demand has stayed relatively stable, one of the things that helps us understand is that those price changes have been mainly supply-side issues. And we kind of knew that already probably, but this helps provide further confirmation for that. So, you know, why were beef prices so high a couple of years ago? Well, it was because 2 years before that we had drought and high feed prices, and it's sort of working itself out in terms of the cattle cycle. And now we've rebuilt the inventory a little bit. We've got more supply and prices are starting to come back down a little bit. And so one of the things this survey helps us learn is that it's not consumers changing what they want that's causing those price fluctuations. It's probably mainly supply side issues. So those are probably two of the biggest lessons I think I can take away from the sort of 3 year look at the data.
Would you say, is it fair to say that this kind of suggests that consumers remain fairly confident in the supply of meat, the safety of it, the credibility of producers producing all of that?
Maybe. I think probably the way I think about it is this consumers like to eat meat. They don't like paying higher prices. So again, when prices were really high a year and a half, 2 years ago, I can tell from, when I write news articles or blogs on my website, I can see the level of traffic it gets. And people are really paying attention when prices are high. Why are prices high? They wanted to know that. But they were still spending the same amount, roughly, on beef and pork. So they weren't buying quite as much because there wasn't as much out there, but they were willing to pay more for it. And so that, you know, that tells me that that people have a strong preference for meat products, and they value that as a part of their diet. So, yeah, I think people are concerned, you know, if you ask them about issues of animal welfare and environment and health and safety. They want producers to be sensitive to those things, but they also like to eat meat. And they do want – I think they do want some reassurance. And as you said, I think that – you know, so why hasn't demand changed a lot? I mean, maybe one of the answers to that is that there are perhaps – have some underlying confidence in the sector that they're making changes that they want to see. But I think, you know, I've already mentioned the sort of high profile negative stories. And so I think that will continue to be a battle going on out into the future.
Well, one of the things you also do on an ongoing basis, you kind of measure which issues are I guess, causing the most heartburn or most concern out there among consumers.
We do. So we track concern and awareness in the news of a whole set of probably 15 or 20 issues, some we've added over the years. On the concern about food safety issue, you know, interestingly, it's not often always the things that wind up in the news. It's often the things that are actually real safety issues. E. coli, salmonella, those things are the things that show up every month as the things people would be most concerned about in their food supply. So that's interesting, you know, sort of traditional food safety. A couple of things I think that I've sort of seen move up over the 3 years a little bit is the GMO issue has become more in the news than it was in the past, and probably honestly something that consumers are probably a little more concerned about. And then I'd say there's probably a couple other ag production issues being, you know, antibiotics is something that's been a lot more in the news, and we can sort of see that in the survey. Yeah. There are more kind of temporal issues we can see when there's a bird flu, for example. That's one of the issues we track, and it'll spike up when there's an event, but it's kind of died back down. Mm-hmm. But I'd say, you know, it's the traditional food safety issues, and then the things that have sort of started to emerge as potential issues of concern in the future are the GMOs and the antibiotic issue.
The ad hoc questions. But, you know, you've got these consumers obviously on the line, so you can kind of explore some things with them. What are maybe two or three things that you've asked over the last year or two that kind of really the results have kind of stuck with you?
So before telling you about some of those, I'll use this opportunity to make a pitch to your listeners. And that is, if you've ever wanted to ask a question to 1,000 U.S. food consumers, send me an email. So you can find me online, Jason Lusk at Oklahoma State. And so normally I try to find a couple of questions every month just to respond to whatever's in the news, current policy issues, current topical issues, or people make suggestions to me. And if I like it, I'll tweak it a little bit and put it on the survey. Probably the one question that created the most attention was a question I added just sort of as an afterthought. It was in the midst of the debate about whether we should have mandatory labeling on genetically engineered foods. And I added a question that asked whether people wanted mandatory labeling on food that contained DNA. Of course, that's a stupid policy, a silly policy, an absurd policy. And the reason is because all food, anything that was living has DNA. You and I have DNA. And what I found was that the same percentage of people, about 80% of the people, supported that policy as did supported mandatory labeling of genetically engineered food. And so, you know, it goes to show that you got to be cautious about some of these survey results and that some of the answers we get from people on surveys, like the one I do, you got to interpret with a little bit of a cautious eye. I don't think it means people are stupid not always thoughtful. But what I think it does say is that people often respond to these with sort of a gut reaction that do you want free information about something you don't know much about? Sure, why not? So they took a difficult question and converted it in their mind to probably an easier question and answered that one instead. But that's sort of, you know, one example of the kinds of things, you know, over time as sort of policy issues have emerged, we've asked questions on people's preferences for soda tax policies, for various policies and issues. For example, when we had the last farm bill debate, We ask questions about support for various farm programs, whether people like the idea of separating debates about farm policy from food stamp participation, the SNAP participation. And then just, you know, again, just a really wide range of issues, sort of try to probe consumers and see what they think on a whole host of issues. How they respond to different information sometimes from different organizations would be another common line of questioning.
Right. Now, I know that, you know, as we talk before we started here, you and I talked a little bit about what sort of things you get as far as requests for information or things that seem to be hot button topics that you get involved with, because you talk to a lot of media people, podcast people all over the United States, and I guess maybe even outside the U.S. as well. But you kind of said that there's a couple of things that are kind of the top of mind of a lot of people.
Yeah, at least for me personally, I'd say most of the media inquiries I get generally fall into one of two categories. Either has something to do with genetically engineered food or sort of new food technologies affecting food and ag. The other thing would be animal agriculture. Mm-hmm. And in particular, either consumer concerns about various animal agriculture issues or the impacts of various political debates and what impacts they would have on producers, on consumers. And again, a lot of those are sort of these issues that come about whenever, you know, the reports come out about, you know, carbon emissions from cattle or whether it's the nutritional guidelines come out and recommend less meat consumption. Those two broad categories of things are things that occupy a lot of the media attention. In terms of the things I like to try to talk about myself, I try to, you know, encourage people to take a bit more of an optimistic look about the use of food and agricultural technology in general. And often when even in the issue of biotechnology or animal agriculture, one of the sort of overarching strategies I try to use is to encourage people to think a bit about using science and technology to help solve some of these problems. That, yeah, maybe there's a policy solution. Maybe you want this tax. Maybe you want that or whatever. But let's not forget that we can still address a lot of our problems and forget about this whole issue of food security and be able to feed people. And one way we can accomplish both of those things, perhaps at the same time, is by investing in science and technology and really making the best use of the knowledge we have available.
On animal agriculture, what are the maybe one or two things that we people are struggling with or wrestling with more than anything else?
The antibiotic issue is certainly one. There's been some legislative change that's causing producers to have to reevaluate in some cases how, you know, they're running their operations. But then there's just the broader issue of how do we have large scale confinement operations? How do we treat sick animals? How do we prevent disease? You know, really the disease prevention one is probably one of the main issues. And so I think it's a difficult issue, and that's why I think it'll be with us for a little bit. The answers aren't easy, and it's not obvious how we want to do that. And I would say it's wrapped up in an animal welfare issue too, because if you have a sick animal, a lot of the retailers out there want programs that are never ever antibiotics. What does that mean? We're not going to treat sick animals anymore. What does that mean for animal welfare? So these are tough issues. So I think that's going to be a big one on into the future. The other, you know, another kind of big topic again, I think, it's kind of being pushed from the retail side, but just the whole sustainability issue, whatever that means. Mm-hmm. You know, food companies for years have had sustainability programs. If I had to be a little cynical, I'd say a lot of those programs have been mainly PR efforts, marketing efforts, but those are starting to sort of push themselves back down on the production side, and there's starting to be questions about metrics and how do we know when we say something is sustainable, what does that mean? And I see a lot of really interesting and probably good efforts out there to ask questions about how do we quantify soil health, for example? Mm-hmm. How do we really know that we're you know, using our resources wisely? Can we turn that into a number? And in a lot of ways, those are good things to do, but it's also a challenge in trying to figure out how we do that and what are the implications on the farm. So I think those are some of the things that when I look out sort of in the future, and especially, you know, getting back to the animal agriculture thing, and you know, what those sustainability metrics mean and how do those things get interpreted are all going to be really key issues going forward.
Seems like we've got some activist groups that have pushed a lot of our corporate boards very hard, mm-hmm. management very hard to do something about cage-free eggs or the gestation crates, or there's other things that are probably on the horizon as well on their agenda. And a lot of these boards just seem, you know, they make a policy and everybody else has got to live with it. I mean, that seems like that's getting to be more and more of an issue with a lot of these companies making these decisions.
There certainly is a trend in on the retail sector to make pledges to go cage-free or gestation crate-free or antibiotic-free or whatever the issue of the day might be. You know, whether those pledges all ultimately materialize in reality remains to be seen. You know, I don't think that's going to go away. And I think the real issue, I think you hit on it, is whether consumers are willing to pay more, because these products and practices do cost more. And I think most producers are willing to adopt new practices if they can make a return doing it. Mm-hmm. I think the real challenge for producers is if they're asked to adopt a more costly production practice that they can't be compensated for, it essentially acts as an unfunded mandate. And I think that's the way I look at it in terms of what the concern is. And so on these boards and in the retail sectors, you know, at least when I talk to some of these groups, you know, I think that's – I try to encourage them to be a little bit cognizant of those. And if you want additional practices, that's fine. But you might need to be willing to pay for it to encourage that adoption. I think we can see in a lot of cases where if a board unilaterally makes a decision but they don't work with the production side of the chain, it doesn't happen. And so you end up with Chipotle, for example, having a sign that says, well, we can't actually sell you the pork we're claiming we have, you know, because we can't find enough producers that are willing to do that at the price we're willing to pay. So all that is a way of saying, you know, we have to, again, going back to my survey, we have to be able to separate out what people say from what they are actually willing to pay. And sometimes those two things don't always line up. And so, I think a lot of the animal advocate groups, environmental advocate groups have a very successful strategy in targeting, corporations and causing some change that would have been very difficult to happen just through the marketplace alone.
Right. GMOs. What is obvious, this is the entire technology that we use in modern production agriculture. It seems like there's a lot of consumers that I don't know if they're scared or they're worried about unintended consequences. Maybe all of the above.
I think the main thing to know about most consumers is that they just don't know much about the topic. Yes, you're right. If you ask a person, what do you think about GMOs? All they know is it's something I should probably be a little bit worried about. But if you scratch just a little bit beneath the surface, what you'll find is there's not much there. I mentioned the DNA labeling question. You know, that's an example of that. Another example would be a question we've asked people about. We ask a question that says something like, how do you want the issue of mandatory labeling on GMOs to be decided? And we give them options like, you know, through ballot initiative, through legislatures, through the FDA. And overwhelmingly, people say by the FDA. And the way I interpret that is to say, you know, they could have chose, I want to go vote on it myself, but they don't choose that by and large. And I think what that tells me is that people want to defer to experts in this case, which is often what we do when we don't have enough information. When we realize we don't have enough information, I'm going to go to my accountant or to a lawyer when I need somebody that has more information than I do. So I actually am somewhat optimistic on the GMO debate. Yes, a lot of food retailers are trying to source and move away from it. That is true. We just had a mandatory labeling bill passed. It's a little unclear how that's going to translate into actual labels on food products. So there's a lot of uncertainty, and I don't think we know what's going to happen. But I'm somewhat optimistic, and I'm optimistic for three reasons. One is the uncertainty, so I think people's minds can still be changed. The second thing I'd say is that, again, when I refer back to this sort of elite media, while they've been pretty negative on animal agriculture, they've been pretty positive on GMOs by and large. And I think, you know, the scientific community by and large is behind the use of responsible use of biotechnology. So to the extent these, the media and science has any impact on cultural views and thoughts about ag technologies, I see those trends heading in positive directions. And then the last thing I would say is the innovation itself. So the first generations of a lot of GMOs and biotech products have frankly been of the sort where most of the benefits have been at the farm sector. And while they've produced real benefits from farmers, actually some benefits to consumers through lower prices, they're not obvious to the consumer. It's hard for them to see. So as we see technologies and products, so now there's this Apple, for example, that's non-browning, or other technologies like that. I think there's also a non-browning mushroom. Those actually may be the sort of things that start to change consumers' mind, because they, you know, the companies that are selling those are not wanting to hide the fact that it's GMO. The GMO is providing the benefit to the consumer. Right. And so when just like most of the products and new things that we buy in life, we buy them because we think they're going to do something for us. And when we see products produced through biotechnology that start to provide real tangible benefits from consumers, I think that'll start to shift the debate, hopefully pretty dramatically. And it may not always come necessarily through food. So there's this concern about Zika right now, and one of the technologies there is some genetic engineering, both of through mosquitoes that can breed with the current population, other fixes on that front. And so there's a lot of real subtle things like that that I think, you know, the innovation on the technology side can play a role in alleviating some of the consumer concerns that exist.
Finally, let's talk about your book for just a moment. Newest book just out, Unnaturally Delicious?
That's the title. Yeah, Unnaturally Delicious, How Science and Technology are Serving Up Superfoods to Save the World. But it's basically a book that tries to paint a bit more of an optimistic perspective about the state of food and agriculture and where we're heading. There's a kind of common view out there, I think, among a lot of people in the public, that if we can just get ourselves back to sort of 1950s agriculture, we'd be better off. That's probably coming from a background where I have some sense of what that was like. I don't think that's a route we want to go. And so what I've tried to do is in each chapter pick an example of an entrepreneur or an innovator or a scientist or a farmer who's innovating, using a new technology in some way to try to make the food system better, and trying to put into practice what I just described, trying to link what's happening on the farm and in the food sector with what the consumer sees. How is this? What does this do for me? So I give lots of examples, everything from new chicken cages that are both good for the farmer and good for the hen. I talked to our own wheat breeder here in the state, Brett Carver, and what he's doing to produce wheat that's disease resistant for the farmer, but also good for the consumer, and how they've been working on all kinds of practices to improve sustainability. I talked to the folks at SST here in town, sort of involved in the precision ag sector, to use more responsibly fertilizer and make the best use of the land that we have. So, every chapter picks an example like that and tries to talk about it from the eyes of a food consumer and through the eyes of the innovator. Because a lot of the folks in the food sector, just like most farmers, they want to do well, both for their family in the future and for the food consumer. And I guess it's my belief that if most food consumers had a better connection with those farmers and food innovators, they'd be more optimistic about the future of food too. So that's really the hope with this book is to instill in consumers perhaps that the way to address our big food and ag problems isn't necessarily to go back to all natural, but to, again, use science and innovation to help address some of our food problems.
Ag economist Dr. Jason Luss from Oklahoma State University. You can keep up with some of the things that Jason's got going in the world of agriculture, explaining production agriculture to the unwashed masses in a lot of cases. JasonLusk.com is his ongoing blog. It's always a pretty interesting read. On the Oklahoma Farm Report, I'm Ron Hayes.